I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
How does that macchiato in there stand up to scrutiny?
Coffee brewing. Making various different kinds of coffee is elevated in Italy, just on a kind of milk to coffee ratio, temperature ratio, just like sort of things like that.
What's your ideal parameters for those things you've listed there, though?
I don't know. I just know that it tends to taste better made by an Italian.
It's like a podcast. Anyone can make a podcast.
Precisely.
But there are ways to make it better. So I was interested to see Jim Ratcliffe's takeover of Nice was ratified. and of
Boo.
Course they played last night and lost to Marseille, which has put the stoppers on their good start, really. But
yeah, back-to-back wins this season.
Yeah, exactly. What do you make of that game? But also before that, what do you make of how Ratcliffe and his money and his strategic decision, as he said in his press release, to take over Nice means for Ligue 1 in general?
Well, as for the game itself, the off-pitch stuff was probably a bit more interesting than the on-pitch stuff. We'll come to that in a minute.
Yeah.
But
less palatable.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, talking of it putting the brakes on Nice's fast start, well, it was always going to be tough because they're struggling with a bad pitch at the Allianz Riviera at the moment. They've had an outbreak of fungus on the pitch, which is something that's quite...
It's fairly common, right?
It's been common in France over the last couple of summers. They've had difficulties controlling it. And the fact that the French national rugby team had played there relatively recently as well, the pitch looked really worn and...
It did.
And patchy. But also, I think when we look at Nice and when we look at Patrick Vieira... We have to say what an incredible job he's done, because he's been through last season. Of course, one of the first things he had to do was deal with Balotelli, who left halfway through last season, obviously after producing very little in the first half of last season when he was still trying to get that move to Marseille, which eventually happened in winter. And he never got a replacement. Like they really struggled for goals last season. Since then, Alain Saint-Maximin has gone. The transfer market for them has kind of been blocked while they've been waiting for the takeover to happen. So the side which he's been going into games with, the surprise is not that they lost to Marseille last night. The surprise is that they won the first two games with what Vieira's had to work with.
Right.
I mean, he has had to coach his ass off so far. I think the biggest thing you can say about Vieira, he's not rested on his name or his reputation or anything like that. He's just asked to be judged on what he's done. Now, Nice do have good facilities. They have a beautiful new training ground. And now they're going to have some more money going forward. But what he's done so far to bring them to the point he has is absolutely fantastic. I mean, they could barely buy a goal through most of last season because what they had up front was powder puff. Nothing's changed yet. They've got a couple of signings ready that they're going to push over the line now that Ineos takeover is complete. So last night in the stands, you had Kasper Dolberg of Ajax and Alexis Claude Maurice, the attacking midfielder from Lorient, who scored a lot of goals in Ligue 2 last season and who Arsenal were interested in and looks pretty fantastic. They're going to sign, well, they probably will have signed by the time you listen to this. So that'll add a little something. They'll need a little bit more, but you know, they're not going to be able to do a massive splurge before the end of this transfer window. Of course, it shuts on Monday. But that's a little start. So losing to Marseille is like a setback, but just a minor setback because what Vieira's done so far is fantastic. And to see what he's able to do with slightly bigger resources will be interesting.
Well, and on that point about Vieira, whenever a club is undergoing a takeover, things like transfer window, your plans in that transfer window get put back because you know, the buyer is doing his due diligence and essentially freezes the actions of the club. And so in terms of getting new recruits in, or certainly some of the players that they plan to get in, that all has to wait for the takeover to be concluded. So French league starts earlier than any of the other top five leagues. Vieira's had to work with the team more or less without new recruits. And now we're seeing this kind of acceleration. And, you know, they are putting some big money down, really. I mean, I was quite surprised, not on the back of the season that he's just had, because I think he is a talent, but they're prepared to pay Napoli €25 million for Adam Unas, who's a very good wide player. Yeah, that's big money for a club like Nice.
Yeah.
I'm also curious to get Andy's opinion on Kasper Dolberg, because Dolberg is almost like one of those Football Manager players,
yeah,
YouTube, Twitter hyped players. And I'd say that since coming on the scene a couple of years ago and people getting excited about him, I remember there was talk of Monaco looking to invest in him when Monaco was seen as the premier recruiters of the next big thing. It just hasn't really happened or taken off for him. And I would say this feels to me almost like a, not a sideways step, but a step down for a player who is regarded as a very good talent.
He's been at Ajax for, what, 3 years and 21
in
now?
In the first team for that long.
Yeah.
I mean, he needs the move. There's no doubt about it. He was surprisingly peripheral to Ajax's brilliant season last year. And I think the notable thing about him going, and this has been on the cards for like a few weeks now that this was going to get completed with Nice, they're delighted to get as much money as they are getting for him, and they're getting a touch over $20 million. And there might be a few little add-ons to go on to that. But yeah, he really does need to re-kickstart his career. And there will be pressure on him straight away because he's coming with a name. And I think you're right, James. Like, people don't pay particular attention to the struggles he's had in the last year, year and a half. And people will be hoping for him to hit hard from early on. And, you know, the French league is a lot more physical than the Dutch league. Funnily enough, I think that's part of the game that he'll be able to stand up to. I think he'll be fine with that. But I think talking about Claude Maurice arriving as well is important, because a lot of Dolberg's job won't just be to score the goals. It will be to occupy the centre-backs so Claude Maurice can make those late runs into the penalty box, as he did, at Lorient. So that could work quite well together. But because they've got so little strength in depth up front at Nice, like they signed Mezien Molida from Lyon last year, and that's not really worked out so far, even though he does have talent. So there's not an enormous amount of forward depth, and Dolberg is going to be expected to produce quickly, and produce, well, every week, really, because they've not got a huge lot of other options.
Yeah, he had a kind of situation where I think people, a few, you know, people in the know, or whatever they want to call themselves, ahead of the World Cup last summer, were kind of saying, look, keep an eye on Kasper Dolberg. He's a good, interesting young player, plays for Ajax, might get a few goals. Of course, Denmark made it through to the knockout stage where they were knocked out by Croatia, but he didn't score a single goal. He didn't really sort of do anything.
No.
And these days, even in 2018, as it was then, the World Cup is still quite impactful in terms of burnishing a young player's reputation, isn't it? So it feels to me a bit like he disappeared off. How important was he, for, in your guys' opinion, for Ajax's Champions League
run
last season?
Let's not forget that ultimately Dusan Tadic played as a false nine, and if he wasn't playing in that position, they had the old Klaas-Jan Huntelaar who would come in and do that.
The Hunter.
The Hunter.
And what a contribution from the Hunter this week.
Yeah.
I mean, the second goal that Ajax scored against Apoel to finally seal getting through to the Champions League group stage, and
we'll talk about that after the draw, so we'll talk about that next week in detail.
What we have to say now is Dusan Tadic did it for them all over again after seeing them through. I mean, people talk about what he did in the group stage and in the knockout stages last season. He was responsible for them actually getting to the group stage in the first bit, which is easy to forget about when you've got all the way to the to the semi-finals. It was a brilliant goal, the second goal against Apoel, and they were stuck on one side of the pitch, Ajax, and they played their way out of it in a very Ajax way. And then Huntelaar, who, remember, they used to make adverts about how he couldn't do anything outside the penalty box, him and Ricky van Wolfswinkel.
Yeah.
He looks up, he sees this really difficult part, he sweeps this brilliant pass all the way across to the other side of the pitch in a way that habitually people have felt, now Huntelaar can't do that kind of thing. Tadic brings it down, smashes it in the corner, 2-0, and that seals everything.
And Tadic and Van Wolfswinkel, of course, two English Football Hall of Famers, and no mistake.
Yes. Without doubt.
I'm actually pleased that, due to some weird sliding doors moment, I'm not going to have to see Dusan Tadic play against Portsmouth at Fratton Park in the League Cup this season. rolling back down to Nice, though, I mean, you touched on it. The game was stopped for a period of time. This home game, they lost against Marseille due to unsavoury homophobic chanting.
And banners
as well. This is becoming a kind of flashpoint in French football, and I think I want to say Italian and Spanish football as well, in principle, around how ultras kind of react to the authorities, or how they perceive the authorities are telling them what they can and can't do in stadiums. Do you want to just expand on that a little bit?
As I alluded to earlier, the bigger issue wasn't really what happened on the pitch, but what was happening off it, because there was this 10-minute delay in the first half. Under these new powers that match officials have to stop a game if there are homophobic chants or banners. And there were both coming from the Populaire Sud and the Allianz Riviera from some Nice supporters. And a couple of the players talked about it afterwards and saying that it was, you know, something that they don't want to see. And of course, it's something that none of us want to see. But this has become like a recurrent theme in the opening weeks of the French season, and not just in the top flight, because referees have these new powers to stop games if there are homophobic chants or banners or expressions of homophobic feeling or use of homophobic language. You had a game between Nancy and Le Mans in Ligue 2 stopped because of that, and the crowd given a warning. Likewise in the top flight last weekend at Brest, and Monaco versus Nîmes, not from the Monaco supporters, because obviously there's very little singing there, but the Nîmes supporters, of which just down the road there were quite a large number. Some of the Nîmes players approached the away fans and asked them to knock it on the head. And it's something that's a real concern, but I think it's really highlighted an issue that's already there, I think, of largely casual homophobia. But these incidents are happening more and more because a portion of ultras from these various clubs where the games have been stopped have taken issue. And I'm not sure if it's necessarily with the idea of cracking down on homophobia, but on their right to say exactly what they want. Mm. Now, this is something we've seen in a lot of different countries. We've seen it with Spurs fans, haven't we? And their what they see as their right to use the Y word, for example. But the way that ultras have reacted to this, they've reacted quite pugnaciously, as if they're saying, well, you know what? If you're telling us how to behave, we're going to react by ramping it up. So whereas, you know, it's something that had to be done. And I think most players are on board with it. Patrick Vieira and Andre Villas-Boas, the two coaches, were saying, you know, it's disruptive to the game, of course, but it's something that has to be done and something that we're fully behind and supportive of. But in the short term, obviously, it's leading to an upswing in use of this language and in use of these kind of in terms of these kind of events.
I think it's really interesting that, you know, in 2019, football is still not seen as an environment in which gay players feel comfortable coming out. Mm. And Albin Ekdal, the Sweden international Sampdoria midfielder, released a video highlighting this issue only a few weeks ago, saying that, you know, in all other walks of life, this is normal. And yet, for some reason, in football, this environment still doesn't exist. And you look at the atmosphere at these games, and you can kind of completely understand, you know, why players would have second thoughts about coming out. Mm. It's just sense. I think it's.
Are either of you convinced by the argument that says, you know, the rise of populism in 2019 around not just the US and the UK, but in Europe as well, and that football stadiums are a reflection of society. So if it becomes more, in quotes, acceptable for people to be able to articulate these kind of old-fashioned, unacceptable opinions, then it stands to reason it's going to be reflected in stadiums because they're a cross-section of those type of people as well.
Possibly, but I feel...
Do people feel emboldened by
absolutely.
That society?
Yeah, they do, absolutely. But I feel quite confident that that will change in the future because when I speak to younger people, I'm talking about children and my children's friends and my children's older friends who are interested in football. When you talk to subjects to them about subjects like this, they're all very nonplussed by it. They're like, why would someone be criticized for being gay? So that makes me feel quite optimistic about the future. But in the short term, if this means that ultra culture has to change, then fine. I mean, we've been here before, I think, because like in the last couple of years in Spain, there's been an anti-discriminatory and violence task force that has looked to crack down on not just regional stereotypes in football chants, but what they feel is, you know, abuse, debasing other people's culture.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think from outside Spain, it's been difficult for people to understand how important that is. And when we see Spain and the Spanish authorities not being sufficiently hard on racism, it's difficult for us to understand in terms of what we would see as a right ordering of priorities. But actually, it does fall into the same category, doesn't it, of hate speech.
I think what we have is a situation where football has always had sort of, I don't know if priding itself is the right word, but it always seems to have subscribed to its own hype when it comes to football industry exceptionalism. Now, we talked about it last season, James, when there were certain ultras at a club in Italy, forgive me, I forget which club it was, that weren't happy that women were allowed to stand in a certain part.
That was Lazio.
Yeah, of the curva or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is if you take that instance there, another instance about homophobic chanting and banners, another thing about racism, all these different sort of pocket issues, which are of course are related, and transpose them onto any other area of society, I mean, it'd be absolutely unacceptable. Heads would roll. Yeah. Heads would absolutely roll in any kind of other organisation. I don't mean about, obviously we've seen problems this season already with racism on Twitter, for example, which is, it kind of attracts the worst part of our society and gives them a platform. But in otherwise fully rounded, accepted, regulated institutions outside of football, this kind of behaviour would be absolutely ridiculous. Yet there seems to be a exceptionalism in football that pervades and sort of rages against the dying of a light because they see it as the last bastion of white working class men's territory, which it doesn't need to be.
Well, and they see stadia as a zona franca, you know,
yeah,
where they can pretty much say and do whatever they like whatever they please, as though it's outside of that society that you're talking about, all other walks of life. And that,
so it's interesting how we, how is that combated, do you think?
Well, by imposing measures like these and getting tough and actually enacting them, because I do think an element of this is territorial. Like, this is totally our patch. This is where we are all powerful. Don't step on it. And I think, you know, while challenging it in the manner that Andy has described, is ultimately kind of self-defeating in that it ends up with that territory being closed and you not having access to it. It's, you know, it's a bizarre culture that these individuals want to defend, you know.
Yeah, I
want to be associated with.
I find it fascinating in a way, in a more broad sense. I mean, I find a lot of the stuff that's been talked about absolutely horrific, of course, as any right-minded person would, but I find it interesting of this idea of exceptionalism, because we also have a as an industry, who, whether it's FIFA traditionally or perhaps the English Football League, as we've seen with Bury and Bolton, and now this kind of thing, where it feels to me as a football fan or a broadcaster in football, that these authorities and associations, they're not really beholden to anyone. I mean, the only reason that FIFA had a kind of, I suppose, surface level ostensible changes at the top was because the FBI got involved, because they were dealing in dollars and the FBI felt that was under their purview, so they got involved and there was a change at the top. But most people are cynical about whether anything's actually changed. You know, it's very, very difficult. If homophobia in stadiums, racism all throughout football fans on Twitter and in stadiums as well, if corruption at the top of the game and all the rest of it carries on in an industry that is so now so large, it's hard to see a decent argument against some kind of independent regulator across different associations to get it sorted, because ultimately it's completely unacceptable. It's a complete time warp and everything is so old fashioned. I understand there are cultural sensitivities around different nations and different ways people handle things. I mean, James, you've spoken eloquently in the past about the divide between the north and the south of Italy, for example, that may seem odd to the rest of us, but within Italy it's a huge issue, right?
Yeah.
So there are cultural sensitivities involved. But ultimately there needs to be some leadership at the top of the game to make this almost a culture change it to becoming unacceptable.
That is true. But if we're taking it back to the start and the way that the LFP is trying to deal with this in France, I think it's really short-term pain for long-term gain.
Yeah.
Because I think what's the most notable aspect about this, yeah, there are some unreasonable people taking it as a challenge. But the fact is, what we have seen is, even though it's very disruptive in the short term with games being stopped, the coaches are behind it, high-profile players are behind it, and to have the industry behind it is a huge start.
Yeah, true.
Henry para Messi. Messi, el pase para Henry es buenísimo. Henry, gol. Gol. Titi. Gol.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This episode of the Football Ramble is sponsored by BetterHelp. Life throws many different challenges at us, and as a result, we all have our own sources of stress. Whether big or small, those stresses can impact our lives in unpredictable ways, and if we don't address them, they can have an outsized and unwanted impact. Therapy is a safe place in which we can address these issues, learn to understand them, and find ways to work through them. Having therapy can be beneficial to anybody, not just people who've experienced major traumas, even if you may have not considered it before. It could be simply a time for you to get things off your chest, a way to learn positive coping skills, or how to set boundaries. Ultimately, it can be whatever you need it to be. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire and BetterHelp will match you to a licensed therapist. You can even switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
We got an email from Kieran Laverick, who spoke to us about Monchi and Sevilla. Now, I know, James, you've got some, I should say, by the way, email at otc@footballrambledaily.com. James, you have got some very fiercely held opinions about Monchi, who came over to the capital of Rome, the capital of Italy, your beloved Rome.
Don't give him any more coffee for the moment.
And you presumably never want to see him again. But
that's not fair.
Sevilla have started well, which we'll come on to. But Monchi's now obviously back there where he was before. He's gone to Roma, come back again. I believe there's a piece in The Offing that's going to be published soon about your opinion of Monchi's time at Roma.
Well, it's a Rome derby kind of preview,
right,
really.
Okay. But we're not using the word character assassination.
Because that would be unfair.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, look, I think... you know, Mochi's reputation is intact. You know, I mean, he's gone back to Sevilla. It's like the 2 years at Roma never happened. You know, he's still this...
Is that just the way he
guru,
likes it?
The guy who knows how to run the transfer market better than anybody else. But I think if you were to talk to Roma fans or just Italian football fans in general, you would say that his time at Roma was not a success, even though in the first year, you know, the team reached the Champions League semi-final. Yeah, there was a lot of expectation around the team and around him, of course, because of the reputation that he's built for himself. But, you know, after him resigning shortly after Eusebio Di Francesco got the sack.
Why did he resign?
Because he tied his future to that of the manager, Eusebio Di Francesco.
Which is strange for a sporting director, because he must understand that management is transient in football and that he's got to have something more long-term.
Exactly, and this was a major bone of contention with the owner, James Pallotta, in that I think in December, Roma had lost a game in the Champions League. There was already pressure on Di Francesco, pressure on the club to take action. And Monchi said, protecting the manager, that he doesn't have a plan B, or plan C, a plan D. And that is exactly what a sporting director should have at all times.
Right.
You must have contingency plans in your drawer for a rainy day when everything turns bad. And he didn't. And yeah, that was one of the things that I would say has been leveled at him as criticism. The other is, if you look at some of the signings that he made, they have really set Roma back. Yeah, because when you decide to spend or commit 42 million euro to Sampdoria for Patrick Schick, who was seen as one of the brightest talents in Italy and one of the brightest talents on the continent in general when they signed him, but had gone to Juventus, and Juventus then decided, actually, we're going to pull out of this transfer. They signed him when they didn't need him. It was an opportunity signing in that, yeah, this is an opportunity too good to miss. And Monchi, I think in the past has said, we had the chance to sign Dani Alves. We didn't need a right back at the time, but I thought this guy, Dani Alves, was so good that I couldn't pass up on the chance to sign him. That was the explanation behind Schick.
Are you sympathetic to that idea though?
to an extent. I mean, I think unless you play a back three, you're always going to need a fullback.
Also, Danny Alves, when he bought him for Sevilla, cost 1/84th of what Patrick Schick cost.
Yes.
Yes.
And,
but yeah, I mean, like, what he's doing there is he's highlighting an aspect of his job which may not seem automatically clear to the regular fan, right? He's like, well, I need to judge these signings on their merits. Now, I understand strikers are different to fullbacks, of course.
Isn't this just a case of dimension? I mean, Monchi always had this feeling in his head, and part of that of course was because he was so entrenched in Sevilla, in the culture. He was there for so long, the club was him and he was the club. But you and I have talked about this, and you're saying, you know, he always thought he wasn't suited to a really big club. I mean, is this part of the problem, that Roma was a bigger club than perhaps he perceived, and mistakes are simply more costly? Because there were those mistakes at Sevilla, you know, you look at, like, when he bought Gansel. Like, Gansel was an opportunity signing, and, you know, here was someone who was thought of as a wonder kid when he was in Brazil, had some injury problems, and he did that thing, really, that in some cases I would say bad sporting directors think or bad coaches think, where they think, oh well, he may have had loads of injuries, he may not have taken off in the way that people thought he would. I can change this. I can be the one to change him. Lo and behold, they get him. He's off out on loan at Amiens before you know it. And then he goes back to Brazil.
He was talked about in the same breaths as sentences as Neymar at the time. It was like Ganso and Neymar were the ones in Brazil doing all the stuff. And that happens in football all the time, by the way. Managers or sporting directors think they're the one to get a tune out of a player. It happens all the time.
I mean, any coach or sporting director is entitled to make a mistake. It happens. I mean, what you're speaking about there is a catalogue of mistakes, but I think a catalogue of mistakes which have been put under the microscope because there was a very big, very bad one early on.
Well, look, I think Roma went into both summer transfer windows with a very specific brief of what the manager needed. A manager you've tied your future to. So you should be doing everything to ensure that manager is a success. And instead, I would counter that, particularly last summer, he was set up to fail. So with Schick, Roma were looking for a right winger who could cut in on his left. And so they were in talks with Leicester about Riyad Mahrez.
But Schick is left footed and can play off the right?
I mean, yeah, I mean, just as I can. I mean,
well, that's going too far.
It's not his natural game.
Sure,
you're asking him to come out of his comfort zone and do a job that isn't his. Okay, they don't sign Mahrez because Leicester stood firm on their valuation, and they signed Schick instead. Schick had been playing as a second striker in a 4-3-1-2 under Marco Giampaolo at Sampdoria. Year one doesn't work out with him. Year two, they have the same need. We need a right winger who can cut in on his left. They identify Hakim Ziyech from Ajax. And they could get Hakim Ziyech from Ajax
for a fraction of the price that he would sell for today.
And instead, Monchi signs Javier Pastore against, for example, Francesco Totti's analysis, his assessment of the situation.
And can I interject here, actually, James? Obviously, we talked before on the podcast about Totti leaving Roma and how much that hurt. How much of that do you attribute to Monchi?
Not a great deal, to be honest. Right. I think there have been a lot of issues when it comes to transparency and who matters when it comes to decision-making at Roma. And, for example, he said we should push for Ziyech. Monchi instead went ahead and signed Pastore, who, to go back, is a number 10. Best that it's number 10. There isn't a number 10 role.
He's also right-footed.
Di Francesco.
He's also injured all the time.
It's also a massive salary because he was at PSG.
And that's the thing. It's not just whether he fits in the system. It's how it goes in terms of your budget and your payroll.
Sure. Mm.
You pay 25 million for a player who's 29 at the time, injury plagued, and you give him a 5-year deal. A 5-year deal, and he's the second highest earner at the club. I mean, again, that has been a disaster. But Totti resigned ultimately because he thought that whatever he said, it just didn't matter. It didn't hold any weight whatsoever. That Monchi would go and sign Pastore instead of Ziyech, and that ultimately the key decisions when it came to Roma's transfers and just general business was made in Boston and in London and not in Rome.
You know, it's what Philipp Lahm feared he would be if he took the sporting director's role at Bayern.
Mm.
So, really, it showed what foresight he's got, right?
Yeah.
Che sono giovani, abbiamo fatto una squadra. Diano una mano. Abbiano i coglioni di dare una mano alla squadra. Io sono là 24 ore al giorno. 24 ore al giorno sono là io. Tutti i giorni, cazzo.
James, what about Inter? Talk to me about Inter. Big result for them on Monday night. Beat Lecce 4-0. A lot of headlines around them because of Romelu Lukaku and Alexis Sanchez and possibly Mauro Icardi. Give us a kind of all-encompassing Inter update. I think I'd call it the Inter story 2019. Tagline, the Conte effect.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Conte effect was in full effect on Monday night. They blew Lecce away. Lecce, newly promoted side, have had back-to-back promotions.
They played quite open, didn't they?
They did. I mean, they went for it. And, you know, they had some chances. I think nothing really clear-cut. Yeah, I mean, they're firm in the belief that if they are going to stay up, they have to be on the front foot.
A lot of teams, promoted teams into top flights are all over the place are doing this now.
Yeah. Mm. Two goals the first half, two goals in the second half. Lukaku scored on his debut. Already signs of a good partnership between him and Lautaro Martinez. But I think the real kind of signs of the Conte effect, as we saw with the Italian national team in particular, how he manages to get a tune out of players.
Candreva.
Candreva, for example, who scores, already a candidate for goal of the season.
Yeah, that was a beauty.
Someone who was heavily criticised last season, couldn't score a goal under Luciano Spalletti, and was always just seen as a kind of symbol of the shortcomings of that Inter side, in that just aimless crossing from wide areas to no one in particular. And he came out after the game and he said, you know, it's a lot easier. And he said this when Conte was the national team manager and was a part of that setup. It's a lot easier for players to go out on the pitch and perform when you know exactly what you have to do, exactly what the manager wants from you. Yeah, he gives me three solutions in this particular situation if I find myself in it. So, you know, it's almost like I can go on autopilot rather than have to improvise all the time.
James,
that's the level of detail Conte goes into.
How much did we feel that with Lukaku? Because, you know, we can talk about not just what a player does in terms of his own performance, but in terms of his body language, the way he carries himself, the way he relates to his teammates, the way he celebrated his goal as well when he piled over to the touchline.
Took a bow.
It feels as if Lukaku is very much at home in a way he certainly wasn't certainly in the last 6 months at Manchester United.
Well, he knew that Conte wanted him. A, because Conte wanted him at Chelsea, and Mourinho ended up signing him for Manchester United to stop him going to Chelsea. And you can see that everything that Inter have done this summer has been well thought out. They know exactly what they want, exactly what system they're recruiting for. Manager, chief executive on exactly the same page, in contrast to our last conversation. Mm. And Lukaku will be set up to succeed at Inter. And you can see right from the get-go that Inter are ready and that even players who come in at the last minute, Stefan De Vrij, for example, picked up an injury in the warm-up. They decided not to risk him and they played Andrea Ranocchia. Ranocchia, who's still at the club. And, you know, Ranno, which means frog in Italian, it's like Conte gives Ranocchia a kiss and he becomes a prince. You know? It's nice. The Conte effect.
How much do you lay... I mean, you talk about Lukaku and perhaps it's a nice and easy narrative to say that he's been freed from the miserable shackles of Old Trafford, and we'll come on to Alexis Sanchez in a minute and see if he can do the same. But what do you make of Lautaro Martinez's role in this? Because I saw something that you tweeted earlier this week saying that he's got a great knack of making other players around him look decent.
Mm.
And he's exciting. He's only 22. I mean, he's his first club in Europe and all the rest of it. Came on board. I think he travelled all the way from Racing Club on a hype train.
Yes.
And stopped off at Inter station. He's played his part in that, surely, based on what I saw against Lecce on Monday night.
Yeah, Lautaro, for me, is a super smart player who, with his movement, runs he makes. A lot of it that goes unseen because it's off the ball just makes his strike partner or even the midfield player who he's kind of bouncing off look very good. Mm. I mean, I remember second half of last season when the Icardi fiasco blew up. All of a sudden, Lautaro is thrust into the spotlight. You know, he has to take responsibility for the team's, you know, sort of attacking production, if you like. And he did it. I watched the derby second half of last season. He was magnificent in that game. And I just think he's one of those players who deserves a chance now to show what he's got. He's had a year to adjust to Italian football. And he's now going to be playing in a system where there is a role for him, because last year it was either 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3. There was only one central attacking role, and that was Mauro Icardi's until everything that happened to Icardi happened. And now there's two positions up there, and I think he's a really good foil for a striker like Lukaku.
But is he going to drop to the bench when Sanchez comes
thing.
In?
Yeah. This is the interesting thing, is obviously when you sign a player like Alexis Sanchez, and we'll get into the actual detail of that deal in a minute because it's quite interesting. You'd expect if Sanchez recovers his best, he'll be playing, I imagine. Now, Inter will be going across three fronts. They need to have backups for those two positions. I think Lukaku, Sanchez, Lautaro, Politano, who seems to be at this moment the other kind of player for that central striking position, even though he's a winger, they will get lots of game time, I think, over the course of the season. But the Sanchez one is fascinating because, as with Lukaku, they are gambling on the fact that United has been a black hole for lots of players under the kind of Woodward, Moyes, Van Gaal, Mourinho era, in that the likes of, you know, Radamel Falcao went there, seen as a massive flop, ridiculed in this country, turns up, goes back to Monaco, wins the league, reaches the Champions League semi-final, and is a protagonist in that. Angel Di Maria, again, someone who flopped there, has been pretty damn good for PSG, has shown that he's still the player he was at Real Madrid. Daley Blind, who did play regularly for United and was seen as a useful player for United, he leaves, and what do we see? He's playing at the centre-back for Ajax. Ajax win the league in the first time in a long time, reach Champions League semi-finals. I think there is a sense that United is the problem, not Lukaku, not Sanchez. Mm. And this is something that Inter are really kind of backing, believing and gambling on. So it's fascinating also seeing that it's a loan and nothing else. There is no option to buy. There is no compulsory purchase order at the end of this deal. So in some respects, you know, if things don't go well for Sanchez quickly, yeah, Inter aren't on the line for anything. They can return him to Sender. Yeah, they've got Lautaro.
I think Man United's portion of his wages still makes him, I think, outside the top six in England, the highest paid player.
So
in the
I'm
Premier
led to believe that Inter will pay 5 million of his wages.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. United's still picking up.
I think they're picking up 175,000 a week.
I mean, this is
for
almost
him not to play for Man United.
This is almost like a carbon copy, almost, of the Nani situation, because you've got to reinflate the value of a player, the market value of a player who doesn't have any at the moment.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Talking of problems, what do Inter do if they can't get rid of Icardi by Monday?
Well, this is a problem, because Icardi has spent the entire summer believing that he can change Antonio Conte's mind. And the likes of Rajana Ingelan, or particularly Rajana Ingelan, who's moved on loan to Cagliari, said, good luck, mate. You're not going to be able to do that.
Well,
you know,
Conte talked about Icardi as an ex-player after the Lecce game,
he was
didn't
like,
he?
We've moved on three of our key players from last year, Ingelan, Perisic and Icardi.
Doesn't look good for that.
What I find really funny about what is, you know, quite a desperate situation for Icardi is that they've signed Lukaku and they've given him Icardi's number 9 shirt.
Right.
So it's like, okay, they've signed a player who plays in my position for a club record fee. They've given him my number.
Locker, yeah, company card.
Ultimately, my days are numbered. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to take the number 7 shirt. what number does Alexis Sanchez play with?
Seven, yeah.
Seven. Yeah. You can imagine that'll be taken off and given to Sanchez. But, you know, I think, unfortunately, Icardi has not learned his lesson in that, last Sunday, first weekend of the season, his wife, his agent, is back on TV, she's back on the sofa, and she's asked about Icardi, and she says that the people that matter at the club, the person that matters at the club, wants Icardi to stay. And that was taken to mean she was alluding to Steven Zhang, the 28-year-old president of the club. So not Conte, not Marotta, the chief executive on the football side, but the president is the one that matters, and he wants Icardi to stay. And the next day, Zhang and Marotta went to the training ground, sat down with Icardi and said, no, that's not the case.
So we're
all on the same page here. You're out of our project. And if we can, we'd like to sell you between now and the end of the transfer window.
So who are the candidate clubs realistically for him?
Well, Napoli are the ones that have shown the firmest interest in him, are willing to put money on the table. Though. Yeah, but he's not a centre forward.
Well, they've signed an attacking player for the club record fee.
Yeah. But they're still very much want to make a statement in the transfer window.
I was kind of approaching it from the transfer, from the funds kind of point of view and the wages and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's much more likely they'll take Llorente on a free by the end of this week. I think that's one thing that they can be pretty confident about. But at the moment, they recognise that Icardi is one of the best finishers in the game. And if there's an opportunity to take him, they'll take him. The problem is that he has had it in his head all summer that he wants to stay at Inter. And I think this goes back to all those other years we've been doing the OTC and people have said, why doesn't Icardi go? Why doesn't he leave? Because he loves Inter. And I think this, again, shows it. Unfortunately, the advice he gets has been really, really poor. And I'm really surprised that, again, after a summer to reflect on all of this, his agent is going on TV again and essentially making his chances of staying at Inter all the more difficult. I mean, they were impossible anyway, but all the more difficult. And yeah, he now, reports in the Italian papers, it looks like rather than actually leave the club, is considering legal action and going to war with the club.
Well, it's not going to get him in the team, is it?
Well, it's not going to get him into the team, but it might, for example, get him to be released from his contract and then be able to find a different situation from there. But the problem is like, you can leave if you want. Inter want to sell you.
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, they've made their home there. They've made their family there.
So there's no chance he'll leave Italy then?
Doesn't look like it. Monaco, for example, have been interested in taking him. And he's not interested in that. I think the only club he'd leave for is the best club in Italy, which is Juventus. And Juventus can't shift the players.
They've already got him.
They can't. They've tried to sell Mario Mandzukic this week. They've been unsuccessful. They've tried to sell Paulo Dybala, not once but twice. Mm. They've tried to sell Higuain. They haven't been able to move the players to kind of ease the burden on the wage bill and bring in money that they could sign an Icardi with. But of course, the president of Inter has said, we will never sell Icardi to Juventus. They're our main rival. They're the team that we want to overtake. Why would we do that? So again, yeah, it's an incredible situation.
Sometimes win, sometimes lose. I have many
difficulties.
Many. Ma me work 12 hours, 15 hours a day in the VAC. My job and my players is not touch.
Αλλά δεν θα κουμπάτε τη δουλειά μου και τους παίχτες μου.
Me touch my players.
Andy, what do you make of this out the fallout of this Porto Benfica result?
Well, it's something that there's going to be fallout from for a little while, I think, because it's so incredibly unexpected. I mean, if I were a betting gentleman, which I'm not especially, I would have staked whatever I had last weekend on Benfica to beat Porto and with some comfort, especially with it being at the Stadio de Luz, especially bearing in mind that since Bruno Lage became the head coach of Benfica initially on a temporary basis back in January, they dropped 2 points in the league.
Yeah.
2 points. They hadn't conceded a goal so far this season. But this was the ultimate expression of Sergio Conceição's Porto and Sergio Conceição's personality, going back from when he was a player to now him as a coach, that he does have this, not just an attacking mentality, an aggressive mentality. I mean, James and I have talked before about, and you know, when you've seen Porto in a Champions League context, about how physical Porto are for a Portuguese side. And sometimes fans of Porto have been quite unhappy that he's seemingly prioritised physically strong players as opposed to technically strong players, or the technically strongest players available to them. And this was like the ultimate manifestation of this, really. Benfica play much more pretty football. We can't get away from that. They weren't able to.
Did they get bullied out of it
in this game? Yeah, they did. I mean, they were quite flat as well. And, you know, we're used to a situation where Benfica play exhilarating football and win at home. But they never even came close to scoring. Now, Marchesin, who's been a brilliant signing already for Porto in goal, not quite enough to keep them from falling out of the Champions League, which is still something that they're really smarting over.
It's a big blow, that, isn't it?
Of course, it's a huge blow. And financially, it has really profound effects for them.
I don't know who's going to be in that easy group that Porto always draw in the Champions League.
And there's no Man United either. They always get an easy group as well.
Portuguese Manchester United. That's what they are. But Marchesin, brilliant as he's been, he didn't have anything to do. And what are the chances of him going to the Estadio de Luz and basically being a spectator for most of the game? Porto won 2-0. They could have won by more. Zé Luís was brilliant, leading the line for them. Moussa Marega, as is his wont, was a little more hit and miss. He missed one like glaring opportunity on the counter-attack before scoring quite a difficult one to seal it. And everything flowed perfectly for Porto. Now we said, like before the game, I said before the game, that you know exactly who Benfica are going to pick. The 11 is obvious. It's maybe not quite the same with Porto. You know, they lost players, again, underlining how Benfica have overtaken them in the transfer market for free this summer. They lost, you know, players of the quality of Brahimi and Hector Herrera, the captain, for free. And, you know, that is such a blow, especially when you think of the financial model which Porto work on. And obviously, they're coming out of a world of shit in an FFP sort of perspective. But
a world of shit. What's that in Portuguese?
O mundo.
O mundo de merda. And they look surprisingly together. You know, there are young players who are coming in and making a difference, like Romario Baro, who a lot of Italian clubs are looking at already and looks a player. But all of a sudden, Porto have a personality again, and it's Sergio Conceição's personality.
Well, they travelled with their own particular coffee machine, the Portuguese national team.
Well, yeah, I don't think they bought it locally. I think it was like brought as
so they
part
could get the coffee just how they liked.
Yeah,
it.
Media facility. Yeah, and it was pretty thick and viscous.
This was a Stakhanov production.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
With the McDonald's app, you can get your favorite thing delivered to your door. So if you were looking for a reason to skip washing those dishes you left in the sink, consider this a sign. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Right now, get $0 delivery fee with any purchase of $15 or more, only in the app. At participating McDonald's, minimum purchase excludes tax and service fees. Delivery prices may be higher than in restaurants. Other fees may apply, not valid with any other offer, discount, or coupon.